thank you for attending our Federalist Society Las Vegas chapter luncheon. We have a great turnout. This is our second event of 2012, and it's really nice to see so many people. We like to think that the current events and what's in the news with the Supreme Court the past few days, weeks, and months has made people start thinking about the kind of judicial issues that the Federalist Society is involved with. Every time we do this, I talk about what the Federalist Society is as an organization of lawyers, and what better illustration there is in the Obamacare argument this week. You have four justices on the Supreme Court. If you look at your brochures on the table, you'll see them openly associated with the Federalist Society. Many of them were promoted as candidates and shepherded through the United States Senate by members of the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is very, very involved in promotion of conservative and libertarian judges for the United States Supreme Court and other courts. I want to introduce our honored guest, Bob Levy, who is with us today. He is the chairman of the Cato Institute, an author and a pundit. He has an interesting background. He came to practicing law in a little bit of a non-traditional way, which I think is great. He attended college at the American University, got a business degree, and then started a career in finance and business that was very successful, selling off his financial services information business, and then being able to focus on intellectual pursuits, going to law school, being valedictorian of his class, and focusing on a career in the law in public affairs, governmental affairs, judicial philosophy. He was a clerk for several judges, Judge Royce Lambert on the United States District Court of the D.C. Circuit, and also Judge Douglas H. Ginsburg. He then became a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, adjunct professor at Georgetown, and then began writing extensively, publishing articles and op-ed pieces in a variety of newspapers such as the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, National Review, Reason, and many others, and has been on numerous TV shows describing the libertarian and conservative legal perspective, such as O'Reilly Factor, Chris Matthews, that must have been interesting, and the Today Show. He remains a fellow at the Cato Institute, where he's chairman of the board of directors. Many of you are aware the Cato Institute is in the news these days as they work through some interesting issues. At the end of our presentation, we'll have some opportunities for you to ask questions of Mr. Levy, and you can ask him on if any topic you care to respond to. So I just note, my last comment is that he has written a book in 2008, which will be touched upon in detail during our presentation, called The Dirty Dozen, How 12 Supreme Court Cases Radically Expanded Government and Eroded Freedom. There's only 12? I think there's more than that. Go to Amazon.com, you'll notice it's got all 5-star reviews. We look forward to hearing about it today. So, Bob Levy, thank you.
Can you hear me okay in the back?
Good.
Okay. It's great to be with you. I did go to law school late. I was actually in my 50s when I went to law school. And I think I may be the only federal law clerk who's been older than most of the judges that he tried for. And I may have another, I don't know this for sure, but it is possible that my son, who's a 2L at the University of Texas down in Austin, may be clerking for the same judge that I clerk for. So this would be, I think, another first, a federal judge who has two generations of the same family. In any event, I am not only an attorney, but I am a Floridian, Naples, Florida, so I get to tell you a lawyer story, a Florida story. So the lawyer story you may have heard announced on the internet this morning that Al-Qaeda has kidnapped 100 lawyers, and they said if the United States doesn't get out of Afghanistan within 2 weeks, they're going to begin releasing the lawyers, one by one, for 100 days. And so here my Florida story, Naples, Florida, where the average age is deceased. And all these stories there about old age, and this one's no exception. This is about a group of guys who resolved to meet. They were visited Naples all the time. They resolved to meet as often as possible for a reunion, but at least every decade. This all started when they were back in their 40s. And so they meet and they vote and they decide where to go to dinner, and they decide they're going to go to the Ritz-Carlton. which is a world-class hotel, and they want to go to the Ritz-Carlton because the waitresses there are very attractive, and they wear these provocative outfits. Another 10 years go by, and they're 50 years old, and they get together and they vote, and they decide to go to dinner again at the Ritz-Carlton because the food and the wine there is spectacular. Fast forward another decade, they're 60 years old, and they all get together and they vote, and they decide to go to dinner at the Ritz-Carlton because it's kind of quiet and sedate, and you can hear yourself think. One more decade, they're 70 years old, and they get together and they vote, and they decide to go to dinner at the Ritz-Carlton because it has elevators and wheelchair access. And then just a week ago, they all turned 80, and they got together and they voted, and they decided to go to dinner at the Ritz-Carlton because they had never been there before. So for some of us, that joke is beginning to hit a little too close to home. Today I'm going to talk about how the Supreme Court has subverted the Constitution, and I'm going to talk about a few of the cases, not a dozen, but a few of the cases that I think have been most destructive, particularly in light of their implications for public policy debates that are going on as we speak. But before I do that, I want to set the stage with a few comments on how liberals, conservatives, and libertarians look at the Constitution differently. And when I say libertarians, I'm not talking about the Libertarian Political Party. I'm talking about libertarianism as a political philosophy, focusing on free markets, private property, individual liberty, and strictly limited government. So at the Cato Institute, where we are all avowedly and unabashedly libertarian, we do not endorse candidates and we don't endorse political parties. But as a matter of fact, we are critical of both the Democrats and Republicans, and as you're soon going to hear, we're critical of both the liberals and the conservatives. What we do have is a consistent, I'd call it a minimalist view of the proper role of government. So conservatives will agree with us on some issues. They tend to be domestic, economic, regulatory, budget, fiscal, tax, spending issues. Liberals will agree with us on other issues. They tend to be the social issues, like the right to same-sex marriage, or to drug legalization, or immigration reform, and in the foreign area, a policy that is non-interventionist, focusing on America's vital interests with a very narrow view of what constitutes America's vital interests. So how is it that libertarians can agree with conservatives sometime and with liberals sometime? Does that mean libertarians are philosophically inconsistent? It doesn't mean that at all. What it means is that liberals and conservatives are philosophically inconsistent. And to illustrate that, I want to suggest that you can grasp the essence of the U.S. Constitution and, in fact, the federal system altogether by looking at the last two amendments in the Bill of Rights, 9th and 10th Amendments. Of course, the 10th Amendment focuses on the powers of the federal government. It says that the federal government is limited to those powers that are enumerated in the Constitution. If they're not enumerated, they're enumerated and not delegated to the federal government, then they're reserved to the states or, depending on the provisions of state law, reserved directly to the people. Of course, the powers we're talking about are things like Article 1, Section 8. There's a list of 18 powers: establish post offices, coin money, declare war, regulate interstate commerce, and on and on. So that narrow view of federal power is shared by conservatives and libertarians. But there are a couple of key exceptions in both the criminal law and the civil law. First, many conservatives, but not libertarians, are willing to federalize, and of course I mean assign responsibility to the federal government, a significant amount of both criminal and civil law. If you want an example in the criminal law area, take a look at our totally futile, feckless war on drugs, for which there is no constitutional authority. The Constitution mentions piracy, treason, counterfeiting. That's about it when it comes to federal crimes. There's traditionally and historically state authority over criminal law, and yet, because conservatives believe that the war on drugs is very important to prosecute, they enlist Congress, and through Congress, the Controlled Substances Act and the DEA to prosecute this war, and doing it very unsatisfactorily to boot. In the civil area, if you want an example of a difference between libertarians and conservatives and the willingness of conservatives to federalize, take a look, particularly in the context of the healthcare debate that's going on, the conservative insistence that Congress get involved in malpractice reform. Now, it may be that medical malpractice reform is a darn good idea and absolutely necessary and long overdue. But the question that libertarians ask is, where is it constitutionally authorized? And of course, the answer you get is, well, it's a regulation of interstate commerce. That's the same answer that the Obama administration is using with respect to the current health care bill. And if you know anything about medical malpractice, you know that typically it's a patient living in one state suing a doctor who lives in the same state about an injury that occurred in the state where both of them live. So it's pretty hard to imagine medical malpractice becoming a regulation of interstate commerce. And yet, conservatives, because they think they've identified this important problem, they're willing to have Congress step in, notwithstanding that there's no real constitutional authority for this. The libertarian position is straightforward. No matter how important the problem is that we identify, no matter how certain we are we have a solution for that problem, if there's nothing in the Constitution that authorizes federal involvement, then the federal government has to step aside, leave the matter up to the states, or better yet, leave it up to private parties. Of course, that isn't what has happened, even though that is what the framers intended. Today, the federal government is immersed in matters ranging from our public school system, again, for which there's no constitutional authority, to hurricane relief or welfare, retirement systems, medical care, family planning, housing, even aid to the arts. See if you can find aid to the arts anywhere under any of the provisions in the U.S. Constitution. Now, there is a second area where conservatives and libertarians differ on powers of government, and that is that conservatives are a good deal more willing than libertarians to focus an awful lot of power in one branch, namely the executive branch, particularly in this post 9/11 trade-off between civil liberties and national securities. Libertarians remind their conservative friends that too much unchecked authority in a single branch of government threatens the whole notion of separation of powers, which has been a cornerstone of the Constitution for the better part of 2 1/4 centuries. So the administration, the executive branch, sorry to say, I mean most particularly the George W. Bush administration, may not all by itself unilaterally set the rules, because that isn't an executive function, it's a legislative function. And while the administration may prosecute infractions, it may not, after the fact, determine guilt or innocence, and it certainly may not determine whether its own actions, the actions of the executive branch itself, have comported with the dictates of the Constitution, because that is not an executive function, that is a judicial function. So that's the powers of government perspective, sort of grounded on the 10th Amendment and separation of powers doctrine. Now, I also mentioned the 9th Amendment, which does not talk about powers, it talks about rights, and says specifically that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights doesn't mean that those are all the rights we have. We have lots and lots of rights that existed before the Constitution was written, and indeed before the U.S. government was formed. And that safeguard imposes another powerful discipline on federal behavior, because what it means is that even if the federal government is diligent in only exercising the powers that are permitted under the 10th Amendment, that is the one specifically enumerated, even if the federal government complies with the 10th Amendment, the 9th Amendment goes further and says even if you only exercise that limited list of powers, you may not do so in a manner which violates our rights. And if you want to know what rights can't be violated, the 9th Amendment instructs that it's not just the ones that are enumerated in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, speech, religion, press, protection against unreasonable searches, and the like. It's those for sure, but it's also the unbounded list of unenumerated rights, which in the libertarian view would certainly include things like the right to gamble, or for that matter, the right to smoke marijuana. Now, if you want to identify, by the way, if you note that the presumptions of the 9th and 10th Amendment are exactly opposite one another, I think you grasp the whole federal structure. The 10th Amendment says that the power in the air, the government doesn't have it. The 9th Amendment is just the reverse. Merely because the right isn't there doesn't mean that individuals don't have it. Individuals have a very long list of rights that predated the Constitution. So if you wanted to identify a specific constitutional provision that separated conservatives and libertarians, it would be the 9th Amendment. Conservatives treat the 9th Amendment, and here I'm using former Judge Robert Bork's memorable term, he says the 9th Amendment is an inkblot. It should be ignored. Nobody knows what it means. It's as if somebody spilled ink on the portion of the amendment that would have identified these unenumerated rights which the libertarians insist that we have. The libertarians treat the 9th Amendment not as an ink blot, but as it means something. And they treat it as if it refers to certain natural rights, the rights that we had by nature, because we are rational human beings, that we possessed before the government was even formed, and that we still retain. Note that the key word in the 9th Amendment is retain. The enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others which are retained. You can't retain what you don't already have. What kind of rights are these? These are all the so-called negative rights. Now, that sounds like a pejorative term, but it's not meant to be. A negative right is simply a right that doesn't impose affirmative obligations on other people, contrasted with a positive right, or properly determined an entitlement, that does impose affirmative obligations on other people. So to flesh that out a bit, let's consider the right to the pursuit of happiness. That's a negative right. If I have the right to the pursuit of happiness, I can exercise that right without imposing upon you any obligation whatsoever, except the negative one. Get out of my way. Leave me alone. Don't use force or fraud against me. Other than that, there's no affirmative obligation on your part. Suppose, however, I had a right to happiness, not the right to the pursuit of happiness, but the actual attainment, the realization of a state of happiness. That would be a positive right, because it would impose affirmative obligations on each and every one of you. If I had an enforceable right to happiness, and bear in mind, if I say I have a right, it presupposes I have a remedy. If you have a right without a remedy, you can't do anything about it if the right's violated. A right without a remedy is if you didn't have the right at all. So if I have an enforceable right to happiness, well, at a minimum, none of you would be able to do anything that would make me unhappy. And if you did, I'd be able to get redress, typically through the court system. Now, these positive rights, of course, are integral to the liberal view of the proper role of government. And because I've been critical of the conservatives, let me be an equal opportunity critic. Of course, the positive rights we hear about in practice are not these abstract rights like the right to happiness, but stuff very much related to that: the right to housing, to welfare, to a minimum wage, to education, to health care, and on and on. Liberals, of course, embrace big government. Why? Because they embrace positive rights. And those two things go hand in hand. Positive rights, by definition, are entitlements which, if exercised, do impose affirmative obligations on others, and occasionally the persons who are imposed upon resist the notion that their resources ought to be confiscated to provide for these positive rights for other people. What happens when somebody resists that notion? Well, you bring in the only entity under our system that is legally entitled to use force, namely the government. And the government, typically through the tax system, requires that I am able to exercise my positive right. If I have a positive right to housing, somewhere somebody has the affirmative obligation to provide me with a house, or if not with a house, the means by which I can obtain a house. So again, big government and positive rights go hand in hand. Oddly enough, however, in this post-9/11 environment, liberals who ordinarily embrace big government are having concerns about big government in one particular area, and that is civil liberties. The trade-off between national security and civil liberties. I think that distrust of big government is a very healthy thing. But why doesn't the liberal distrust of big government when it comes to civil liberties extend to distrust of big government when it comes to so many other areas, like our control over our retirement system, our welfare system, our public schools, and private economy? Why hasn't the left's concern about big government extended to support for smaller government, like privatized Social Security or school choice, or the elimination of regulations that controlled everything from the size of a naval arch to the ergonomics of office equipment? And why is it that the liberals, concerned about big government, can't see past two particular agencies of government? All the other agencies can get as big and bigger and bigger, and that's okay with the liberals, but not the Justice Department and not the Defense Department. And those two agencies, of course, are charged with an indisputably legitimate function of government, which is to protect us against domestic and foreign predators. So one wonders if Congress were to delegate to the Justice Department, especially if we're still under, say, Ashcroft or Gonzales, the power to craft regulations regarding the trade-off between national security and civil liberties. And Congress said to the Justice Department, here's your guideline, keep us safe from the terrorists. Well, folks on the left would be apoplectic, and they would have every right to be, because it's not the job of the Justice Department to be crafting regulations. But when the same Congress turns around and delegates the Environmental Protection Agency the power to craft regulations regarding the trade-off between economic growth and a clean environment, and it gives the EPA no more guidance to keep us safe from the pollutants, the folks on the left applaud enthusiastically. So is it the case that pollutants are a greater threat than terrorists? Not likely. What is more likely is that the left has a selective indignation about big government. And that reflects, I think, an inconsistency in the liberal mindset, just as there is on occasion an inconsistency in the conservative mindset about the proper role of government. And that is the foundational question, the proper role of government. And I think in examining that question, the Constitution can be viewed through these two prisms. The powers of government prism, which is the 10th Amendment, the rights of individuals prism, which is the 9th Amendment, and if you wanted to capture the libertarian view in a nutshell, it is that the powers of government should be interpreted very narrowly, and the rights of individuals should be interpreted very broadly. And we would argue that was precisely the vision of the framers, and I think it's fair to say that the framers were in fact libertarians. So that's a little bit of backdrop. And now let me talk about just a few of these, I think, very important cases. They're important. Most of them occurred 70 years ago. You know, I went back to the New Deal to pick out these cases. But they're important because of the implications they have for current public policy debates. I want to preface it by noting that it's been 221 years since the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. And interestingly, since that time, we've only had 17 constitutional amendments, despite the fact that our framers could never have imagined what our 21st century world would look like. So how is it only 17 amendments? I mean, some countries have had 17 constitutions in 221 years. How is it we've only had 17 amendments? There are lots of reasons, of course, but I think there are three that are relevant to today's discussion. One is that the framers were geniuses, and they had a vision of liberty every bit as relevant today as it was back in 1791. The second is that in exercising their genius, they had the foresight to craft an amendment process that was pretty difficult. Essentially, two-thirds of both houses have to propose amendments and ratify by three-fourths of the states. That's not an easy thing to accomplish, so it's not surprising that it's only happened 17 times, and as a result, we've had a very stable constitutional framework. The one reason that's not so good, I think, is that the Supreme Court has accomplished through the back door what the states and the Congress and the voters could not have accomplished through the prescribed amendment process. In effect, the Supreme Court has rewritten parts of the Constitution, and that has implications for all of us. So a couple of these very, I think, bad cases. The first one is about the General Welfare Clause, or more broadly, the power to tax in order to provide for the general welfare. And as you know, the taxing power is a big thing at issue in the Obamacare debate, whether or not, in fact, the penalty that's imposed if you don't buy health insurance, whether that penalty is a tax, and if so, wouldn't therefore the mandate to buy health insurance be authorized under the General Welfare Clause, the power to tax in order to provide for the general welfare. Well, this came up in 1937 in a case called Halperin v. Davis, and the issue there was the constitutionality of the Social Security system. Of course, in judging that, you have to think like a judge. It's not whether the Social Security system is a good idea, or whether it's actuarially sound, or whether guys like me like to get their checks every month. The issue is, where in the Constitution is the federal government authorized to tell us, first, that we must provide for our own retirement, and second, the means by which we use to do so? And if you ask the proponents, they say it's the Social Security is a tax, and it does provide for the general welfare. Well, this went way back in the beginning, was a battle between Madison and Hamilton. So Hamilton argued that we have all these powers, 18 of them in Article 1, Section 8, and he argued the General Welfare Clause is an extra added power of Congress. In addition to the power to declare war, regulate commerce, coin money, on and on, you, Congress, also have the power to tax in order to provide for the general welfare. Madison said that can't be the case. Everything can be characterized as providing for the general welfare, and if we give Congress the power to tax to provide for the general welfare, we've effectively given Congress unbounded powers, and that's not what we intended. What we intended was a government of limited and enumerated powers. And Madison even went a step further. He said, not only isn't the General Welfare Clause an extra power of Congress, it's actually a restriction on Congress's existing powers. What it means, according to Madison, is that even if Congress limits itself to the other powers limited, enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, Congress has to jump through one more hoop. It can only exercise that limited list of powers in a manner that promotes the general welfare and not the welfare of what Madison called factions and what we today call the special interests. So long story short, the Supreme Court took a look at this and basically said Madison loses and Hamilton wins, and that opened up the floodgates. The Social Security system was considered to be constitutional, and through these floodgates, the redistributive state was ready to pour. taking money from some people and giving it to others without any constitutional constraint. And today's manifestation of that will be the argument that the mandate, the penalty under the mandate, is in fact an exercise of the taxing power to provide for the general welfare. Now, that argument is not going to go very far, I don't believe, and it hasn't gone very far in the lower courts, and principally because the mandate says it's a penalty, not a tax. The word tax was in the original version of the legislation and was stripped out and replaced by the word penalty. The word tax appears elsewhere in the legislation, so Congress certainly knew how to use the word tax when they meant tax, and they know how to use the word penalty when they mean penalty. Of course, the purpose of a tax is to raise money. If this penalty under Obamacare worked exactly as it was intended, it would raise exactly zero. Its purpose is not to raise money. Its purpose is to coerce people into buying health insurance to basically subsidize the big insurance companies so they can afford to cover pre-existing conditions. Of course, we know that Obama promised us over and over again there would be no new taxes on the middle class, and that's why he did not want this characterized as a tax, at least not until the time that it went into court. And then he insisted that it was an exercise of taxing power. I think the administration's better argument is under the Commerce Clause, and that is that the Obamacare mandate is an exercise of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. And that brings me to case number two, which is the infamous 1942 case of Wicker v. Filburn, the Commerce Clause case, where the issue was, does Congress's express power, we know it's there in Article 1, Section 8, to regulate interstate commerce, does it extend to activities that are not interstate, not commerce? And of course, if the answer seems self-evident that it should be no, it couldn't possibly. You haven't been watching the Supreme Court for the last 70 years. Mr. Filburn grew wheat on his own farm. He didn't buy the wheat, he grew it. He didn't sell the wheat, he ate it, or he gave it to his farm animals. So there was no commerce. Commerce, of course, is buying and selling. There was no commerce. The Roosevelt administration decided that the price of wheat during the Depression was too low. Told Mr. Filburn, we got to raise the price. The way we do that is cut back supply. You, Mr. Filburn, have to stop producing so much. And Filburn says, under what authority? And Roosevelt says, the Commerce Clause. And we're regulating interstate commerce. And Filburn said, well, guess what? It's not interstate. It's all on my farm, all within one state. I'm not buying it. I'm growing it. I'm not selling anything interstate. I'm eating it or giving it to my farm animals. Again, the Supreme Court took a look and said, Filburn, you don't get it. If you weren't growing this stuff, you would have had to buy it. And if you weren't eating everything you grew, you would have had some left over that you could have sold in interstate commerce. And when we consider the fact that you grew and ate instead of bought and sold, and the fact that there are other people doing the same thing, the aggregate of all of the people that are doing what you're doing will probably have a substantial effect on interstate commerce, and therefore you come under the Commerce Clause. Now, this opened up a second set of floodgates for the regulatory state, regulating anything and everything under the rubric of the Commerce Clause. And it's Wicker v. Filburn that paved the way for this noxious notion that Congress can even punish the failure to purchase a product, namely health insurance, from a private company. That, of course, is unprecedented. As you probably know, it's illegal to purchase health insurance across state lines, so there is no interstate market indeed to be regulated. And if Congress can mandate the purchase of health insurance because it happens to be related to health care and we're consumers of health care, then why not the purchase of other things that are related to health care? Why couldn't Congress require us to purchase exercise equipment or a membership in a gym or a subscription to Weight Watchers? This individual mandate would extend the dominion of the federal government to virtually all manner of human conduct, including non-conduct, and it is, I think, the legacy, if it is approved by the court. It will be the legacy of Wicker v. Filburn. Third case, again, with implications for today's economic crisis, and that is about the Contracts Clause. The case is called Home Building and Loan Association for Supplies Act, 1934. And the Contracts Clause couldn't be more crystalline. It says no state shall impair the obligation of contracts. That wasn't clear enough for the Supreme Court, which upheld a Minnesota statute that, see if this sounds familiar, postponed mortgage payments for financially troubled homeowners, never mind the contract. And of course, we're now seeing a replay of that as lenders are being pressured to waive foreclosures on mostly subprime and some other mortgages. Now, we're not just talking about mortgages that were fraudulently induced. Those are not enforceable. There are plenty of laws on the books to take care of that. And we're not talking about foreclosures accompanied by inadequate or incorrect paperwork. That, too, should not be permitted, and it can be handled under existing law. What we are talking about is mortgages voluntarily entered into by lenders and by borrowers, where both parties assess the risk. Obviously, after the fact, one of them assessed it incorrectly. But now, never mind that contract, the lenders are being pressured to waive their foreclosure rights. Again, the legacy of this 1934 case, Home Building and Loan versus Blasting. Fourth case, again, with the financial crisis. This is about something you don't even study in law school nowadays because it's more or less dead, and that is the non-delegation doctrine. The case is Whitman versus American Trucking. The very first sentence in the Constitution, right after the preamble, says that all legislative power is vested in Congress. Why? Because, again, the framers were smart guys, and they knew that if Congress passes these oppressive laws that the voters don't like, then the voters have a remedy. You can vote the bums out of office. But what's happening now, of course, is that Congress passes laws that nobody even understands. And in the case of Obamacare, with 2,700 pages, it passes laws that nobody even reads. And then they delegate, the members of Congress delegate the authority to flesh out the details, to put flesh on the skeleton, fill in the gaps, to one of the 320 alphabet agencies, which are executive or administrative agencies in Washington, D.C. If you like this notion of delegated legislative power, even though the Constitution obviously says you can't do that, then you will love TARP. The Troubled Asset Relief Program, what we colloquially call the bailout, where lawmaking power was basically turned over to the Treasury Department, first Secretary Paulson and then his successor, Secretary Timothy Dyton. So Paulson decides, without any congressional input whatsoever, Paulson decides we're going to purchase toxic assets from troubled banks. Within a few months, he changed his mind and said, no, we're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to directly invest. We're going to reject capital into these institutions, particularly the ones that are too big to fail. Then along comes Geithner, his successor, and Geithner says, no, what we really need is a public-private partnership, again, without any congressional guidance, by which he meant, of course, that the private bankers, to the extent that profits materialize, would get to keep those profits, whereas if losses materialize, they'd be picked up by the public. That's the public-private partnership, the public meaning all of us taxpayers. And along the way, of course, the government expropriates $180 billion to bail out insurance giant AIG and a few tens of billions to bail out the auto companies, despite an express declaration by Congress that there was to be no automobile bailout. And what have the courts said about this? The voters can't say anything because these agencies are run not by elected officials, but by unelected bureaucrats. What have the courts said? Essentially, they've said, yeah, we know it prohibits this in the Constitution, but governing is a very complicated business nowadays, and we really do need these 320 alphabet agencies helping out by passing laws and regulations of their own. So we're going to make an exception to the non-delegation principle, and the exception is Congress can delegate legislative authority, notwithstanding the Constitution, as long as Congress lays down an intelligible principle by which the agencies know how to flesh out the details. So ask yourself, what was the intelligible principle that Paulson and Geithner had to follow? Nobody knows, least of all, the taxpayers at foot picking up the bill. But the principle seemed to be make things better, and that is not a coherent guideline to legislative activity. Next case you're going to be hearing about just about every day up until the election. As a matter of fact, if you pick up the New York Times any day of the week, you will find a criticism of this case, namely Citizens United, about campaign finance reform. But there was a precursor case, and that was McConnell versus FEC. That was the bad case. Citizens United is a good case, as I'm going to flesh that out in just a moment. The background goes like this. The campaign finance reformers had this quixotic notion that money and politics don't mix, and so they passed McCain-Feingold in 2002. And we know how well that works because we had an election, presidential election, 6 years later, during which more money was spent than any election in the history of the universe. So much for McCain-Feingold, which ultimately was codified as BICRA, BCRA, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and challenged under the First Amendment by Senator Mitch McConnell and others in McConnell versus FEC. a 2003 case, 1 year after McCain-Feingold was passed and was challenged. The Supreme Court in the McConnell case upheld McCain-Feingold and thereby gave political speech, which is, of course, the foremost form of speech that we were trying to protect under the First Amendment, the most important kind of speech, to be able to criticize or support your elected candidates. Political speech under McCain-Feingold and under this decision, McConnell versus FEC, got less protection than Klan speech, flag burning, and pornography. All of those things are protected to one degree or another, as in my view they ought to be. But some forms of political speech under McCain-Feingold are not protected. What kinds of speech? Well, suppose you're a corporation or a labor union. Let's say you're a big publishing company like Random House, and you publish a book, and somewhere tucked away in the 600 pages of the book are three words: vote for Obama or vote against Obama. That book would be violating McCain-Feingold and it could be banned. Now, we're not supposed to be about banning books in the United States, and that's the reason that the Supreme Court took another look at this issue in the follow-up case, Citizens United versus FEC. And happily, in January of 2010, the court in Citizens United overturned two of McCain-Feingold's worst restrictions on corporate and union political expression. The first was the one I just mentioned. No corporation or union advocacy can expressly support or expressly advocate the defeat of a clearly identified federal candidate. The second provision, which was overturned of McCain-Feingold in the Citizens United case, was just about as bad, and that is no distributed ad funded by a corporation or a union can even mention the name of a federal candidate. You don't have to say so. I vote for. You don't have to say vote against. You may not even mention the name of a federal candidate within 60 days of an election or 30 days of a primary. It's okay if you go far away when you don't care about mentioning it. But the closer you get to the election, the more this becomes forbidden under McCain-Feingold. This case, Citizens United, was about a movie called Hillary the Movie. It was critical of Hillary Clinton, who was a candidate at the time for federal office. Now, under McCain-Feingold, you could go watch the movie in the theaters, and you could even buy the movie on DVD. But Citizens United, the corporation that produced the movie, could not advertise that the movie was available to be seen. And they could not advertise that the DVD was available to be purchased. Now, that's the inanity of the McCain-Feingold regulation. Justice Kennedy, in a very narrowly decided 5-4 opinion, correctly recognized that corporations and unions are not this monolithic block of money that comes in on one side of an issue and distorts the political process. Typically, we have corporations on one side, and unions will oppose them with countervailing blocks of financial support on the other side, even within the corporate community. When it came to Obamacare, you had Walmart, it was very much in favor, and you had Whole Foods was very much against. The really, I think, unfortunate thing about this Citizens United case, particularly, again, if you read the daily pages of the New York Times editorial page, is that it's been misrepresented, grossly misrepresented by the liberal press. And the first aspect of that misrepresentation is the claim that this case is all about whether corporations get treated as persons. Now, that's a really interesting issue about which is a wealth of legal scholarship, has nothing to do with this case. This case is not about the rights of corporations, it's about the rights of individuals, like the folks in this room, to pool their resources and express their political views through any venue that they wish, whether it's an organization or a partnership, an LLC, an LLP, a corporation, or a labor union. It's not about the rights of those entities, it's about the rights of the individuals who decided to pool their resources and use those entities as a vehicle. The second misrepresentation is that you will hear over and over again that this case, Citizens United, opens up the path for an avalanche of money to be flowing into the coffers of political candidates. Wrong again. It is illegal, even post-Citizens United, for a corporation or a labor union to commit to contribute a nickel to any political candidate. What corporations and labor unions can do is they can spend their own money now and they can fund independent expenditures, advertisements, without the restrictions that were imposed by McCain-Feingold. Those advertisements may not be coordinated with the candidate or with the candidate's political party. Now, does this mean we don't have a money problem? Listen, if we have a money problem, big money problem in elections, it's because we have a big government problem. Overweening government has sort of wormed its way through just about every aspect of our daily lives. So it's no wonder that we have these lobbyists for corporations and labor unions running to Washington, D.C. to curry favors with politicians, because that's where the favors are doled out. So if we want to get rid of, if we have a money problem, we want to get rid of that money problem, the way to do it is to cut government down to size, to restore the notion of a government of enumerated and limited powers, and that will minimize, if not eliminate, the influence of big money. One more case, and we'll have some time for questions, and that is a case you've all heard of, a 2005 case called Kelo versus City of New London, eminent domain up in New London, Connecticut. So Mrs. Kelo lives in this cherished home, and her neighbors, and they love the neighborhood, and they want to stay there, and here comes a private developer, and he goes to the City of New London, and he says, I want you to condemn these homes, and let me have these homes. And of course, the city wants to know why, and he says, because I have contacts with Pfizer, and they're going to build a big pharmaceutical plant, and along with that pharmaceutical plant, we're going to have a big hotel and some office buildings. And that's going to really expand the tax base and increase the opportunity for jobs. Well, when they opposed this to Ms. Kelo, she wasn't wild about it. She wanted to stay in her home. And when they told her they were going to condemn her home anyway under eminent domain, she said, well, what about the Fifth Amendment, where it says that you can only take private property for public use? And when we think of public use, we ordinarily think of roads or military bases or government office buildings, not Pfizer pharmaceutical plants and not the hotels and office buildings to be developed by a private developer. Well, the Supreme Court weighed in and basically said that we understand that the Fifth Amendment says you can only take private property for public use, but we're not going to interpret public use to mean public use. We're going to interpret it to mean public purpose or public benefit. And while this property that we're going to allow to be taken under eminent domain might not be serving a public use, it certainly is serving a public purpose because it's expanding the tax base and creating a lot of jobs. Of course, if those are going to be the criteria, then nobody's home is safe from the government bulldozers, because it is always possible to take somebody's home and convert it into commercial or industrial use and thereby expand the tax base, or for that matter, create more jobs. Fortunately, there is an epilogue, and that is that the Institute for Justice, on whose board I'm happy to sit, that litigated this case and lost the case in court, took the case to a second court, and that's the Court of Public Opinion. And as a result of a media crusade by the Institute for Justice, 43 states have now effectively trumped the Kelo decision. Of course, states can't affect federal law, but under state law, these states have reined in the use of eminent domain for purposes of economic development. And therein lies two, I think, interesting lessons, the first of which is there's more than one court in which you can win a case. So even if you lose in court, at least if you're a public interest lawyer, you always have the option to go to the media and to the public and try to get legislative relief, and that's indeed what the Institute for Justice did. The second interesting lesson is that the U.S. Constitution sets a floor, not a ceiling, on protection of your rights. So the states can always give you more protection for your rights than does the U.S. Constitution. There is one other interesting fact about this case, and that is if you go for a ride up in New London, Connecticut, to sightsee and see the brand new Pfizer pharmaceuticals plant and the office building and the hotel, you won't find them because they never got built. As a matter of fact, if you go to where Mrs. Kelo's house was, of course, her house and her neighbor's house are long gone. If you go there, you will find a vacant lot, so much for economic development. So to sort of wrap this up, we shouldn't, in a free society, shouldn't have to ask for government permission to participate in an election. We shouldn't be forced to buy health insurance or bail out the automobile companies or insurance companies. But those abuses of power can be minimized only if the judiciary is vigilant in binding the hands of the legislative and the executive branches with the chains of the Constitution. And I think, regrettably, the Supreme Court has been derelict on occasion in fulfilling that obligation, and I think it is time to restore constitutional government. Thank you all very much. So last time I spoke this long, a guy came up afterwards and said, you know, if I only had 35 minutes left on this earth, I'd want to spend it with you. And I said, boy, that's flattering. Surely you'd rather want to spend it with your family or your friends. And he said, nope. You're the only one who can make 35 minutes seem like an eternity. So I hope it hasn't seemed like an eternity. I'd be happy to answer questions if there are. Yes, sir.
Several questions. First of all, if a drug user overdoses and is laying on the sidewalk, does the government or society have any obligation to offer that person medical care?
Well, you know, we don't have a duty to rescue in the United States. Most European countries do under tort law. You can't be required to rescue. So if you're asking me about a legal duty, the answer is we do not have a legal duty. If you're asking about a moral obligation, that's quite a different story. But I think we ought to resist the temptation to conflate morality and politics. Morality is about the determination of right and wrong behavior, good and bad behavior. Politics is about the relationship between a person and the state and the government. So while it may be the right thing to do to help a person who is destitute or who is lying in the gutter, that does not mean we call the government in to compel us to do such things. There are lots of things that are right to do that we don't insist that the government step in and intervene between us and our decision process.
And the second question is, if we strictly construe the Constitution, precisely what provision of the Constitution grants the Supreme Court the power to declare anything unconstitutional?
Well, of course, it's been pretty well resolved by
Marbury
versus Madison.
Right, but there is no specific constitutional provision that says the power granted to the Supreme Court is to declare acts of Congress or anybody else unconstitutional.
Yeah.
So a strict construction, it would seem to me, would not allow the court to do that.
Yeah, of course, you know, you have to go beyond the text of the Constitution when the text of the Constitution leaves us in a murky area where we don't know the answer. And if you look at the Federalist Papers, particularly Federalist 78, you will find by Hamilton, I think, unequivocal statement that that the courts will have the power to declare acts of Congress to be unconstitutional. Madison said the same thing in others, other of his writings, as did even people, anti-federalists like Patrick Henry. So I think among the framers there was a unanimity of opinion. Well, perhaps that's too strong. There was certainly a majority opinion that the courts would have the power to declare acts of Congress constitutional, and to the extent there was any doubt, we pretty well put it to rest with Marbury.
Thank you.
Sure. I read portions of your book, and in your book you find, as you mentioned today, that the Social Security Act should be unconstitutional. You even go so far to say that it's a Ponzi scheme, even though it was passed by the latest Congress, by President Roosevelt, and the Supreme Court affirmed it. Now, the Ponzi scheme is a criminal enterprise. Are you suggesting that those offices and persons are criminals?
I'm certainly suggesting that the Social Security system is unconstitutional. I'm also suggesting that the Supreme Court has disagreed with me. They did not ask for my input when they made the determination that the Social Security system was constitutional. So it being having been determined to be constitutional, it could hardly be determined to be a crime. Were we to treat this all over again, I do think it certainly is unconstitutional. Whether I go so far as to saying these folks had criminal intent, I don't know about that. I mean, there are certain other criminal law requirements for charging a person with a crime that may not have been met in this case. And that is to say, the intent may have been beneficent, but the fact of the matter is that the Social Security system is not authorized by the Constitution.
That was your word in your book. You called it a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it is a Ponzi scheme. Yes, sir.
Could you comment upon the concept of judicial restraint, which seems to have an elastic meaning depending upon who's construing it? If you read the Los Angeles Times, it's a horrible abuse of judicial restraint that a majority of the Supreme Court may vote to invalidate the Obama health care laws unconstitutional. If I understood the last portion of your remarks, I think your definition of judicial restraint would be closer to the court has got to apply the Constitution to strike down congressional actions which go too far, which go beyond the text and meaning of the Constitution.
Right. Well, let me put it this way. I think this choice between judicial activism and judicial restraint, these are terms that I don't think ought to be used in this context, because there are times when judicial activism is certainly desirable and other times when it is undesirable, and the same thing can be said for judicial restraint. So the real question is between judicial abdication of its role under the Constitution and judicial intervention such that the judges become super legislators and think that they can impose upon the electorate policies that they would have supported even though the legislature did not. I don't think there can be much question that we do want judges to step in and overturn laws that passed by Congress and supported even by supermajorities if those laws are not in compliance with the U.S. Constitution. You know, I represented Mr. Heller in the case of the Heller versus District of Columbia, the Second Amendment. Now, the D.C. City Council passed overwhelmingly, and the citizens of Washington, D.C. overwhelmingly favored an outright ban on all guns for all people at all times for all places. And yet, the Supreme Court did, in the Heller case, step in and overturn that. That is a proper exercise of judicial engagement, judicially engaged intervention to strike down a law which quite blatantly was unconstitutional. On the other hand, when the Supreme Court steps in and finds rights in the Constitution that do not exist, entitlements that do not exist, and acts as though the court has the power to pass legislation to create these rights, that's an improper exercise of judicial activism, if you want to call it, but it's actually judicial policy making. And of course, the reason we have too much of this is because we've gotten away from the text of the Constitution toward this notion of a living Constitution that basically makes judging politics by another name. It substitutes an objective written standard. It substitutes for that the policy preferences of individual judges. And to the extent that they then exercise those policy preferences, they are engaged in judicial activism of the very worst sort. So I'm not a particular fan of these terms, activism and restraint. I'd rather say judicial abdication, which is something that we should not have, and judicial engagement in ascertaining whether laws pass muster under the Constitution is something we definitely should have. Yes, sir.
Are there 5 or 6 votes to invalidate the individual mandate?
Well, there's certainly 4 votes to validate it. There's no question that the 4 liberals on the court are a rubber stamp for constitutionality. And whenever you hear the fact that the Supreme Court is politicized, it's always in the context of the 5 guys who vote on the conservative side. It's never in the context of the 4 judges who you can rely upon with absolute 100% certainty that they're going to say that Obamacare is constitutional. What about the 4 conservatives and the swing vote, Justice Kennedy? They are by no means a slam dunk for saying that Obamacare is unconstitutional. And the reason for that is twofold. First, conservatives has a healthy respect for stare decisis. Let the decision stand. Precedent. The precedent is lousy. Wicker v. Filburn, Raich v. Gonzalez, Helbrin v. Davis, these are lousy precedents, and conservatives tend to give some weight to precedents. Only Justice Thomas among the conservatives gives very little weight to past precedents and insists that if a law is unconstitutional, it should be invalidated no matter what the past precedent. The second thing is that conservatives are very reluctant to engage in what some folks have labeled judicial activism, and that is stepping in to override the wishes of democratically elected legislatures. And Obamacare, however sloppy the process, was indeed passed by the U.S. Congress. And so a lot of conservatives are willing to say, oh, gee, that's what the voters wanted. They have their elected representatives. Their representatives passed it. And we're not going to intervene. Indeed, that's what J. Harvey Wilkinson, a very conservative judge on the Fourth Circuit, wrote about the Heller decision. And that's what Richard Posner wrote about the Heller decision. That this was an example of judicial activism. And now you're hearing from some conservatives, although mostly you're hearing it from Obama, that if the Supreme Court steps in and overturns Obamacare, that would be an example of judicial activism. It really isn't. It would be an example of judicial engagement, determining whether or not the acts of the legislature are constitutional. A very appropriate thing for the federal courts to be involved. So, in answer to your question, there's a I think a 55% chance we'll win this. I thought going into the oral argument less than 50-50, but coming out, the oral argument is very good. And coming out, the briefs are great. I'm happy to say Cato wrote, I thought, a series of briefs in all of the cases that led up to the Supreme Court and briefs in the Supreme Court as well. I think the briefs are great, and I think we have better than maybe 55-45 chance of having the mandate overturned. Separate question as to whether the rest of the statute's going to go. And I hope it does, but the really key issue is whether or not the Supreme Court is going to finally recognize that there are some limits to the exercise of federal power under the Commerce Clause in particular. If it does that, that will be victory enough. If it also throws out the rest of the statute, that'll be terrific. Yes?
What is the libertarian view of the extent of the penumbra of rights under the Ninth? And from a practical perspective, I mean, we know that it comes from natural rights and Locke and all that stuff. What are the parameters of that, and what are the consequences of recognizing, you know, the real extensive parameters in terms of either judicial action or legislation?
Well, the parameters are those that I think I tried to outline, and that is, we think that the Ninth Amendment protects all negative rights, rights that can be exercised without any implications for other people, without requiring other people to engage in affirmative activities to benefit.
And yet there was no enumeration of that by the founders.
There was no enumeration because those rights are boundless in number, and they could not possibly have been enumerated. In fact, that was Madison's concern about having a Bill of Rights to begin with. He thought if we have a Bill of Rights, people will misconstrue the Bill of Rights to suggest that the rights that are enumerated are the only ones we have. And he got around that finally by including the Ninth Amendment, where he made it quite clear that these are not the only rights we have. But it does remain for us to find out, to try to determine, what are these other unenumerated rights? And as you note, it's a very, very difficult question. Our view at the Cato Institute, or at least my view, I can't speak for everybody, but my view is that the Ninth Amendment protects all negative rights, which are rights to do any darn thing you wish, as long as it does not interfere with the similar rights of others to do what they wish. Rights that do not impose affirmative obligations on others. So the right to smoke marijuana is a negative right because I don't require your help to do it. The right to a minimum wage is not a negative right because somebody has to be forced to provide me with a minimum wage if he might not otherwise be willing to do so.
So then does Congress have the power to enforce by regulation or legislation all of those unenumerated natural negative rights?
Well, if you're asking me whether they can enforce them against the states, is that what you're saying? I mean, what it would mean is not that Congress has the power to enforce, but rather that Congress does not have the power to violate these negative rights, nor does the state have the power to violate these negative rights. Then it's a separate question whether if the state does violate those negative rights, does Congress have the power, or does the federal judiciary have the power under the 14th Amendment and the notion of incorporation to step in and stop the state? And our answer to that would be yes. The federal government does have that power. That's a whole watershed in federalism principles. Originally, as you know, the 10th Amendment governed federalism. The Bill of Rights only applied to the federal government. First Amendment, Congress shall make no law. Doesn't say anything about the states making law. We found out for 80 years that the states can be just as tyrannical as the feds, the slavery being the obvious case in point. Fought a civil war. Post-Civil War amendments, including the 14th, which has now been interpreted to have the effect to incorporate or make applicable these various rights, including, we would argue at the Cato Institute, the unenumerated rights in the Ninth Amendment, make those rights applicable against the state, and so if the state does violate those rights, the feds can step in and put a stop to it. It gives the feds a new power under federalism, not just the enumerated powers, but the right to stop the states from violating certain rights. In the back.
What is the practical effect when the Supreme Court strikes down the personal mandate for these rights of health care in place? Are we left in a situation where now employers are required to comply with the provision of insurance, but the only thing that's struck down is that people don't have to purchase their own insurance?
Well, you know, not even the government is arguing that only the mandate, that if the mandate is stricken as unconstitutional, that it's the only thing that should be stricken. The government has not been willing to take that position, and the court actually had to appoint an attorney, court-appointed attorney, to argue that. And that attorney did argue that the mandate, if it's declared unconstitutional, that falls and the rest of the statute can stand. The government's position is, if the mandate stands, then not only the mandate, I'm sorry, if the mandate's unconstitutional, then not only the mandate, but also the obligation for insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions has to be stricken, but that the rest of the statute can still stand. The position of the Cato Institute and the states and the folks on, I guess I could call it our side, is that the entire statute has to go. And if you recall how that statute was passed, kind of interesting. The House, the Senate passed a version of Obamacare. The House passed a different version. The usual process is you come together in conference committee. It goes back to the House and Senate, and they have to vote. And they have to approve what the conference committee came up with. And then, of course, it becomes law, assuming that the president signs it. But a funny thing happened on the way to the conference committee, and that is Scott Brown got elected in Massachusetts. And so the Democratic Senate knew, if the House and Senate, if that went to a conference committee and it came back to the Senate in a slightly different form, which meant the Senate would have to vote on it again, it would never pass because now the Democrats did not have their 60-vote filibuster-proof majority as a result of Scott Brown's election. And so the Senate said to the House, you must pass this bill in the exact same manner that we passed it. No amendments. You can't take out provisions and tweak them. No amendment. It has to be the same thing because we can't have it coming back here. And indeed, that's what they did. So it is quite clear, at least from my perspective, that the intent of Congress, both houses, was to pass this bill as an integrated whole without any amendments whatsoever. And so to suggest now that this thing can be picked apart and that certain provisions can exist in the absence of other provisions, I think is a misreading of the legislative history. And I hope the court will see it that way. That's a separate matter, by the way, as to whether, as a policy matter, these things can stand alone or they can't stand alone. This is a matter of whether, in the legislative trade-off, quid pro quo, log rolling, tit for tat, in the legislative trade-off, was it the intent of Congress to pass this as a piece of parts that could be put together, cobbled together, with some of them deleted, or was it passed as an integrated whole with everybody saying, okay, we'll take this entire package, but only if it's an entire package? The history is it was the latter, not the former. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much.